You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for a community forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning Pete Knutson and Brett Barnicott. Pete is a longtime fisheries activist and a Seattle Central professor, and Brett is with the Save Fisheries Terminal group. So, did I get that right, Brent?
Save Fisherman's Terminal.
I'm sorry, I wrote it so quickly this morning. So, obviously, you're both in here to talk about the situation at Fisherman's Terminal here in Seattle. This week ago, I believe, the Port of Seattle unanimously voted to allow yachts into the terminal, and we'll get into that. I want to start out, though, and ask you guys if you can give us kind of a brief history of the terminal and how it came to be.
I'll take a first cut at it, I guess. We're talking about 1913, early part of the 20th century. You had a situation where the railroads controlled most of the waterfront, and certain basic public functions were not being carried out because of private interest. And so the public got together and created a public improvement district known as the Port, which was sort of parallel to the public utility districts at the time. And established certain piers, fishing areas like Fisherman's Terminal, where the North Pacific Fleet could tie up. This was done to ensure that basic public functions were completed, like having a home for the food harvesters of the North Pacific. And in the early years, the business community was very, very suspicious of the Port Commission, and they sort of had to prove their loyalty to business for years and years and years. And then eventually they became a very conservative institution and actually became captured by those business interests. And Fisherman's Terminal, the first docks were built in 1914, and we're still walking on those docks today as they're collapsing. And and the rest of the small boat area, that when you go down to Chinook's right in front of you, that's all World War II stuff. Most of it built the year that Hitler invaded Norway, so that has a certain resonance in the Ballard community. Now they have not really, the Port Commission has not reinvested capital down there since 1946, except for one dock, which they constructed for the factory trawlers in 1987, and a little retail sort of gentrification action that they did up on the shore side. And so that's a little bit of the history.
One more thing, what they were after down there, there's a couple different ways to slice and dice a business, whether you're a short-term profit or a long-term. And the port commissioners down there looked this thing over, and they didn't really have the idea of a marina or a yacht club, which plenty of existed at that time. They looked at this, if they gave a very, very reasonable rate of moorage, that a large fleet would locate there, because this is, you know, moderate wintertime conditions, even though some people are complaining here today, it's nothing compared to Alaska. And you can get a lot of work done. And in fact, this fleet did locate there because it's fresh water. And it's basically the candy store. Anything and everything you need for marine industrial type work can be done there, from welding propellers to boat building itself. And although they didn't make a lot of money on the rents down there, all the local businesses make quite a huge sum of money in that activity. It's some $400 million in a down year. It can be four or five times that when the fisheries are up. And we all have business cycles. Everyone does. And so the local taxing authorities were also behind this, because it generates a huge amount of taxes. So it wasn't like it was just philanthropy by any stretch of the imagination. This is what's called public investment. There is a big payback in the number of jobs, and this is a huge chunk of the industrial tax base of Seattle right there.
That's right.
All right, and my understanding is the Fisherman's Terminal is the last working facility on the West Coast. Is that right? Or at least up until a week ago
it was? It may be the last. We think it's the last working commercial facility on a major scale in the continental United States. And you travel in Europe, and you'll see very few anymore either. I went to Barcelona last year, and their fishing fleet is cordoned off into a little corner there. Everything's been taken over by mega yachts. So this is a unique situation that we have here in Seattle. I mean, it's absolutely unique. And instead of treating it as, oh, this is old-fashioned, let's move on, as Claire Nordquist, the president of the Port Commission, said, Pete, just forget about it. We have to bring the yachts in. That's progress. No, this is something that we've got that's unique, that's not only a connection to our heritage and our history, but is, for blue-collar Seattle, is a bulwark of economic stability.
All right. So then we take the what the port has done recently, which is say basically we're bringing in some yachts to help pay for the empty slips. I understand there's about 350 slips or thereabouts, and about a third of them are currently empty. How did that come to be, that the slips are empty?
Well, it's actually a kind of an odd way to measure something, and that's, again, what the port wants everyone to talk about is the term of vacancy. The port has done, as they should, hired outside professionals. The pros from Dover, in this case, were a group called Martin and Associates out of Philadelphia, where they sliced and diced every waterfront activity. And you will find measurements like jobs per acre. And, you know, in capacity, in terms, the term vacancy actually is completely absent from the study. So from a public relations standpoint, it's something that the public can understand. But in fact, really, if you're measuring an industrial plant, which this is, capacity is the term. And are we at full capacity? No, we're not at full capacity. But the fact is, you can't really mix and match. It's not the best analogy, but, you know, small children love to play in sand and gravel. Would you ever consider taking a small child to a sand and gravel cement batch plant to let them run around until they need it to make it into cement? Well, of course not. You know, that's why we have zoning and separations. And that's what we have here. We have a separation. The whole idea of slipping in a few boats while somebody else isn't there, that's not the real issue, although it does create a lot of sparks. The real issue here is a land grab. They want the uplands. When I was a youngster growing up around there, when the wind blew from the south, you would smell the Inner Bay dump. And there were enough seagulls there that I was convinced that's where they filmed Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. You know? It's definitely changed, yeah. You know. And now as they look at it, it's like, well, this is just ripe for gentrification. And if you see the sweep coming down 15th Avenue, or ask any poor resident of Magnolia or Queen Anne what it's like to get off and on the hill from 4 to 6 o'clock, it's impossible with the traffic. And this is before the ImGen, ImmuneX, or whatever it's going to be by the time they're done buying each other out, is built down there. We're looking at a huge development just parading right on through the industrial lands.
Let me just add one more thing to that. That was good about the vacancy issue. See, essentially what the port's done is they've taken the eyes off the prize. As Brett points out, the real issue down there is, what is the contribution to our economy? That's one of the major issues. It's also a cultural site. And the economic contribution is still massive. I mean, we're talking $410 million annually between wages and business revenues that comes out of that terminal. 5,300 jobs. That's huge. I mean, we are talking about a facility with no capital investment that dwarfs the productivity of any other port facility, where they have dumped massive money. Harbor Island, they dumped $250 million for American President Lines. Terminal 18, they dumped $300 million for Steve Doring Services of America. Those two facilities alone are $500 million, and you're looking at about 3,500 jobs. And here you got Fisherman's Terminal, no serious investment since 1946, 5,300 jobs. I mean, that's phenomenal, because those people are working on collapsing infrastructure down there. And what's been happening is that systematically, our docks have been collapsing. They've now, on Dock 5, you go down, they've put great big steel sheets over the planks so people don't fall through. We didn't have an operating crane for the last year to offload fish. They've taken away a lot of the net area. They've jacked up the rates on critical marine suppliers that are moving out of the area. Everything the port has done has served to kind of constrict this noose on the industry. And when you sit back and you look at it, you say, this is a familiar pattern. What this is the classic slumlord tactic. When a slumlord has an urban property and wants to develop it, what they do is they allow the property to go to hell. The roof starts leaking, don't fix the window. Pretty soon the tenants start moving out. The tenants start leaving. And to some degree that's been happening. People have been leaving the terminal for Port Townsend, for Anacortes, for Alaska, because they're making it so it's very, very difficult to work on your boats down there. And then once the tenants start leaving, then the slumlord says, hey, let's clean this place up. Let's have a little gentrification here, which is exactly the fate that almost befell the Pike Street Market. And thank God we stopped that. So the vacancy thing is absolutely absurd. They don't talk about vacancy rate at the cruise dock, which is mostly empty. They don't talk about vacancy rate at the container terminals. You know, they want to measure us as if we are simply an apartment building or marina. And it's not, as Brett pointed out, it's not an adequate or an appropriate form of measurement for an industrial facility.
Is it true the Seattle Fire Department condemned some part of Fisherman's Terminal?
It's always kind of interesting that you're looking at an administrative district is what the Port of Seattle is, and they're the ones that actually control that area. But if you ask a fireman or you take them through or when they come down to their own fire prevention tours, they just shake their head. They don't literally have the rights to control that area, as odd as it seems, even though they're the ones responsible for putting out a fire. So, yeah, they won't drive on those docks. You can't drive on the docks. We have to take the change out of our pockets on some of those docks before you walk down, and there's actually causeways to go around, and it didn't happen overnight.
So we've got fire problem down there. I mean, we have a serious fire problem.
Yeah, if it caught fire down there, you'd definitely see it from outer space. You wouldn't need a spy camera at all. There's a lot of fuel down there, and it's not adequately protected. We've actually got pictures. Now that we've brought the media down, they've cleaned up a little bit of that, but there's been fire prevention devices behind barbed wire fences for 6 months at a run.
Okay, so would it be fair to say that the situation is that you guys are renters and the Port of Seattle would be the landlord on this?
Well, I think we're more than renters because at the original deal, we were invested into this property, not just culturally and historically. That happens over time. Wherever people work, stay, live, and operate and live their lives, worship, whatever you do in your daily life, your culture and your history rubs off, and Fisherman's Terminal definitely reflects that. We have that. It's everywhere there now. But, it's our home. And like the original benediction, if you will, by the first port commissioner, Hiram Chittenden, said the purpose of this facility was to organize and solidify the scattered fishing industry of the Northwest, to provide a home for the extensive fishing fleet, to give such aid as the port rightfully should give in protecting the fisherman and marketing his hard-earned products. This is surely an ambition worthy of the most earnest efforts of the Port Commission. Now, when it comes to marketing salmon down there, it's very odd. You're actually almost prohibited. Pete and a couple others have bravely fought this.
It feels like you're dealing drugs or something. Yeah, we just want to sell fish. I mean, like healthy fish.
You know? But you're not allowed to sell there, whereas you could actually take your catch and sell it at another port facility under a different rule scheme. Now, this sounds kind of odd, but the reason behind this is landlords often share in a tenant's profit, anywhere from more commonly 5% around the city. At the one fish operating plant that's down there, fish seller, and it's a good place. They do a good job. But they have an exclusive for the entire terminal, and the port takes 15%. So if Pete and I are selling fish, they don't get anything from that. So they've squeezed out all the fishermen from selling and forced everyone to go to this market, so they get the rake off. Whereas you could take your fish down to Shilsho or Bell Street or somewhere else and sell it. But this is being challenged as well.
All right, and I understand the port was going to, at some point, build some facilities for sale of fish down there?
Yeah, when they did the gentrification in 1987, they tore down a perfectly good wharf restaurant. You know, there was no reason to tear that down, but they wanted to put a new face on it, so they built Chinooks and they built the Highliner. And that's fine. Chinooks does a good job. And that's when the memorial went in. Of course, that wasn't paid for by the port. That was independent fishing groups that paid for that memorial down there. And I just spaced out your question.
Oh, that the port had said it was going to put in a facility for
sailfish. Yeah, right. Okay, that I knew there was a little synapse I was missing there in my brain. So our end of the deal was, hey guys, we're going to build you a 20,000 square foot facility for direct sales to the public and for auction. And this would be a tremendous thing for us because we are being hammered by processors in Southeast Alaska who are also dealing farm salmon and have cut our prices back to 20 cents a pound, 25 cents a pound, and we've got a great product and we'd like to bring it directly to the public. And so here, this was held out to us, and 20,000 square foot building was going to, $3 million was budgeted for it, and they reneged on it. They pulled it out. And every time that we meet with the Port Commission, we say, you know, we're not digging in our heels and saying no development down there. What we want is sustainable economic development. What we do not want is to turn that place into a playground for the wealthy, which seems to be the direction they want to. That's not sustainable. You know, the issue is not vacancy rate, and the issue is not, are fishing boats sustainable? Well, they are sustainable. The issue is, are yachts sustainable? I mean, how can you build an economy based on sipping martinis on the back of a yacht? It doesn't compute to me. So we were promised that, and that's where we have to go. That's where the people of Seattle want to go. When I talk to people about the possibility at Fisherman's Terminal of having, on the land side, a big steel building where you could bring down the Ballard Farmers Market bring down all the truck farmers, set them up on land on the weekend, and then build a few finger floats and have crab, halibut, salmon, tuna, you name it, frozen, fresh, however the guys have it. You'd have one-stop organic shopping, one-stop wild salmon shopping. It'd be a great thing on the weekend.
Actually, it was in Japan recently in Tokyo. They have facilities like that.
There's many ports on the West Coast that have it, or Stevenson just over the border into Vancouver has it. You know, it works. It's not like this is some sort of a fantasy or something that needs to be subsidized. But in fact, why we were promised this facility, the 20,000 square foot facility in 87, is that there's what you call an indirect benefit. I mean, people come to Chinooks, and again, they do a fine job, and it's wild fish. It's a good place to eat, but you know what goes on there is people aren't going to Chinooks because of just the food. They're going there because of the backdrop, and we are the backdrop. And since we were going from the wharf, which was the kind of a restaurant where you had your choice of hanging up your overalls at the door or wearing them to the table, it was the old school kind of a place where it was there was no such thing as sexual harassment. It was graded. It wasn't reported. You know, it was just kind of a rough and ready waterfront kind of a place, but. We became sort of a fishbowl down there, and we were to capture the indirect benefit of people coming to Chinooks, and part of that trade-off, again, was a place for us to sell our fish.
Okay, so getting back to the concept of being a renter, which you've made it clear that you are much more than that, yeah. But if we simplify it to that, you guys have been paying rent for number of years now.
Yeah.
How much money are we looking at there, and where has that money gone? I mean, how is it that this terminal is falling apart if you've been paying the rent?
Well, that's... You know, when you talk to the old timers down there, they'll say, you know, we have paid so much rent over the years, and the port takes out a charge every year that they call depreciation, which is not what a taxpayer would normally think of as depreciation. It's money they take, green money they take out of the revenues of the terminal as a capital set-aside fund. And they have been doing that since 1914, and yet we're sitting on top of a 1914 and 1946 dock. Normally, those things are replaced in a 25, 30-year schedule. You know, in the case of the 1914 facility, we are, 1939 to right now? Is that 62 years behind schedule? And yet they continue to extract this capital replacement fund. The bottom line is the fishing fleet has paid for the replacement of that facility for new docks probably two or three times to this point. And that money has been siphoned off and used for other port purposes. And so it's not fair. You know. And now, finally, when the port has to come down and invest money, and the only reason they're doing it is that the facility is collapsing. It's full of rot. It's dangerous. We're lacking fire. They had no choice. You know, these other port facilities where they've got a single corporation, they'll dump $250 million in. Here at Fisherman's Terminal, what's the difference between us and those guys? The difference between us and those guys is that we are 500 mom-and-pop operations, and those guys are one corporation. And so they have far more pull with the commissioners. We've paid for that facility already. And for them to hold the $35 million cost it's going to cost to repair that over our heads and say, we have to destroy Fisherman's Terminal to save it. How are you going to pay for this? I mean, that's the club that they're holding, and the public doesn't understand the financial backdrop and what kind of shenanigans the port is pulling on that.
Yeah, we're also, 500 tight-fisted mom-and-pop organizations, we're as opposed to one big revolving door. You can look at the Political Disclosure Commission reports, and it doesn't add up. You know, why would someone spend $200,000 to $400,000, some as cheap as, maybe just $100,000, but still, the Port Commission job pays $7,000 a year. You get it for 4 years. Who invests $200,000 to get $28,000 back? I mean, obviously, somebody else is getting that money back. We're not making those political contributions, but you can see some big revolving doors with preferred clients, a lot of them in the real estate business.
It just seems odd. I mean, when you're looking at the investment, that it's the current plan on upgrading the terminal is about a 6-year plan, $35 million,
right.
And they just completed part of that, the electrical. Is that right?
Well, there's actually a lot of shorts going on out there. But they're working on it. They're working on it.
So $35 million compared to the other port projects we've seen recently.
It's a drop in the bucket. And even Shilshoal, it's a pleasure marina, has their 10-year capital budget is over $60 million for it. And of course, the really egregious example of port spending, they talk about Saddam Hussein's palace. Walk down to Bell Street. I mean, it's $200 million, and it's unbelievable. Just someday when you're down there walking around, walk into that place and go into the restroom. They have folded linen towels with attendants that come in and change them. I mean, you think about the money they spent, $200 million for a cruise industry that comes in, that employs 400 people, that makes an economic contribution of $30 million, one-thirteenth of Fisherman's Terminal, and that was $200 million they spent on that. Or you look at their headquarters at Pier 69. It is just dripping with money. It is unbelievable. So I've never been in a more regal public official type context. It's just the money they're spending. So Fisherman's Terminal, this is just a drop in the bucket for those guys. And so when they talk about, oh, we've got to bring in a few yachts because we'll raise an extra $100,000 or $200,000 a year, I mean, it's so hypocritical and so laughable when you look at it in terms of the context, the real context of port spending priorities.
Yeah, we have there's a group down that working, and it's a, you know, quasi-democratic, but a Fisherman's Terminal Advisory Group, and they've done a lot of hard work, but when we talk to this group, and Pete and I bring in some of the paperwork from the other districts, because what happened is the port split every group off, and you know, this group at the Fisherman's Terminal was told that they were supposed to try and run it like a line of business and pay for itself, and then we let them know that the other facilities are on, you know, an IV drip champagne. You know, it's like, wait a minute, and then explain to them, like, oh yeah, we got to raise the rents down here, whereas the cruise ships are paying no rent. So here's a multi-billion-dollar foreign-owned corporation. Now, if you're going to invest something like the Washington State Ferries, they first went out to bid on the super ferries in the 60s, and the bids went to San Diego. You got a little bit of a cheaper boat, but there was no multiplier effect. That whole sum of money left town, the jobs left town, the taxes. And then the next round, they said, okay, if you're a local bidder and you're within 10-15%, we'll consider putting it here, which they did. And I think it was Todd Shipyards did the next round. All that money stayed here, and there was a multiplier effect. There's no multiplier effect with the cruise ships. Foreign-owned, they pay no taxes, obey no environmental laws. There's not even minimum wage jobs. There's no minimum wage, no overtime working on those boats. You know, those aren't the kind of jobs you really want to build your economy on.
Plus, you got 3,000 people living on those boats pooping right into Puget Sound. There's no sewer hookup.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what's with that? I mean, they could easily hook one in. The Washington State Ferries have shown them how to do it for 30 years. It's not a problem.
Which was interesting when you brought that up, Brett, at the meeting a couple weeks ago. Claire Norquist interrupted your testimony and said, "No, that's wrong. That stuff is not pumped into Puget Sound. It goes elsewhere." And didn't really seem to come up with an answer. He said some of it goes into the ocean.
Yeah, well, I don't think he understands that the ocean's connected, but I don't think he's understanding that he's connected to the human race here either. If you don't make 100,000 and live in the highlands, you're not on the same planet as Claire.
But it didn't instill a lot of confidence if you were just a bystander listening to that for the first time, which I was. So.
Yeah. Well, the actual agreement that they've done, which again is questionable in its legality, but who's got the money to challenge all these things, is it says that they won't crap at the dock. That's it. So I think he's confusing, you know, the bay here, Elliott Bay, with Puget Sound. I think if you had to throw a map in front of him and say, you know, where does what start, he might be a little bit off. But the fact is the law reads, you know, their agreement reads that they won't do it at the dock. Where at Fisherman's Terminal, we have an agreement, which is only reasonable, that if you're living on your boat while you're working on it down here, which a lot of people do, they come from somewhere else to work on their boat, you will pump off. It's just that simple.
It's responsible. I mean, what they do, they have an agreement with the Coast Guard. The only way they make Coast Guard specs is they have to get the fecal coliform count down, get the bacterial count down. So they mix the poop with formaldehyde, and that kills the bacteria, and then they pump the whole mess out on the top of the water column. That's how they do it.
Which is actually worse. You'd rather have live poop than poop with formaldehyde, you know?
All right, help me understand something here. Reading up numerous articles on this issue, I came across a mantra by the people that are for the pleasure boats using Fisherman's Terminal that was repeated over and over, and it's, we have to keep it affordable for the fishermen, and that's the seems to be a big reason why they're doing this. I'm having trouble understanding how bringing yachts makes it more affordable for the fishermen. If those yachts aren't there, do you guys get your mortgage rates raised or what?
It's the old game of free beer. You know, you walk around the terminal and say, like, if you guys don't make any waves here and you allow that these pleasure boats to come in, your rates will stay the same. These guys don't realize that historically the reason we have our rates as they are is because the payback on this whole monstrous facility down there is not rents. It's not running as a marina. Is that this is an industrial tax base. you've got blocks and blocks and blocks of jobs all around there supplying this facility. We're supposed to be the magnet and the draw there. It's not a marina where you come and hang your hat and, you know, do your thing. The whole point is it's a work zone.
So when they talk about subsidizing commercial fishermen, essentially our standpoint is that we have built this community, you know, and if you look at the $35 million they want to invest down there, you look at that as a public investment. You say, is that a good investment? Don't call it a subsidy. Call it a public investment. Okay, 40-year life on the new facility, multiply 40 times our annual economic contribution to the Seattle, $400 million. That's a $16 billion payback to the community in jobs and wages and business revenues over 40 years for $35 million investment. That's a damn good investment. You know, so don't talk to us about subsidy. That's just a game. You know, yachts have no place in an industrial zone, and they are undermining the industrial zoning of the city of Seattle, and that's why Council President Steinbrück came out with a letter opposing this move.
It's blockbusting, frankly, is what it is. It's blockbusting in reverse.
All right, we only have about 3 minutes left. Where do you guys go from here now that the Port Commission has basically said they're going to allow the yachts in?
Yeah, it was a 5-0 unanimous vote. They're just like the Politburo. Every vote is unanimous.
Yeah. No surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, and even the so-called new guy on the block fell right in line.
Yeah.
Well, we're moving ahead. We're moving ahead. We've got we want to take this back to the voters, and you know, it's like here you got a situation where you've had lots of public hearings, a huge hearing at the Nordic Heritage Museum. Everybody has opposed this proposal, and yet the port goes ahead 5-0 and votes it through. Yeah. What does that tell you about the democratic process? Well, it tells us that we have to find, you can't convince these people because they're just operating in somebody else's back pocket. So we're going ahead with an initiative of some kind, and that's what's in process right now.
Yeah, we've got some, you know, excellent help here. We've got State Supreme Court Justice, or retired State Supreme Court Justice Phil Talmadge, helping us with the legal end of it, and a lot of other people who have been very active and successful in dealing with community issues like this, like Matt Fox and others that are helping us out. So we're making big strides forward here, and anyone who would like to help out, we've got a website up, www.notforyachts.com.
Very good. And you have a phone number for people that don't have access to the
internet? It's 528-2559. And if you'd like to come to a public event and talk about us with about some of these issues with us, we're going to be at the IBEW Hall. I think it's on First Avenue on January 24th. It's a Thursday night at 7 o'clock. There's a forum on farm salmon and genetically engineered salmon, which of course is a central concern to our industry. And so we'll be down there. We'll be talking about that. And if you want to talk to us directly about how we're going to save Fisherman's Terminal for the people of Seattle, we'd be happy to talk to you at that time.
All right. And that's next Thursday. Do you know the time of that?
I think it starts at 7.
All right. And I believe, yeah, the hall there is at 2800 First Avenue.
Great.
Very good. So with that, we are unfortunately out of time. So I want to thank you both for coming in.
Great. Thanks for doing what you're doing, Don. This is a lot nicer facility than KCMU, but spiritually, I'm not sure, you know.
Thanks very much.
All right. We've just been talking with Pete Knutson, who is longtime fisherman activist and professor at Seattle Central Community College, and Brett Barnicott, who is with Save Fisherman's Terminal.